through the theology of the body.
Tune in for great advice, guests, and the information you need to take your marriage, family, and personal life to the next level.
Weekdays at noon on Ave Maria Radio.
Catholic Radio in Metro Detroit. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
My guest in this hour has been on Church and Culture before, Robert Hutchinson. We talked about his very interesting book, Searching for Jesus, New Discoveries in the Quest for Jesus of Nazareth. And I found Robert Hutchinson so interesting, I've asked him back. He also is the author of The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Bible, another book entitled When in Rome, A Journal of Life in Vatican City, and one of my favorite titles of one of his books, The Book of Vices, a collection of classic immoral tales, a parody of Bill Bennett's bestseller, The Book of Virtues. Robert Hutchinson, welcome back to Church and Culture.
Thanks for having me on, Dale.
Now, we've turned the corner into 2016, and we are already, for good or for ill, very involved in the 2016 presidential campaign. And in many ways, it seems to dominate the news from day to day. And as you know, I'm for many years invested a lot of my time and energy into the relationship of the Catholic Church to political process, to the Catholic vote. And I'd like just to pose a question for you, and we'll go from there. In a book I wrote a few years ago called Onward Christian Soldiers, The Growing Political Power of Catholics and Evangelicals in the United States, looking at the relationship of religion and politics and the impact of religion and politics, I came to the conclusion that the Christian voter, whether evangelical or Catholic, would only continue to have influence if the role of religion, that is, participation and identification in the United States, remained vibrant and remained substantial. And now it's been 7 or 8 years since I wrote the book and published it, and I've been reading various Pew reports and so forth about the decline in religious identification, decline in participation, even among, you know, the once very vibrant evangelical movement. First part of the question is, do you think that those polls and those reports are accurate? And secondly, do you think there'll be as robust an influence on this election coming from those groups as there has been in the past?
Man, what a question.
let's just get it out there.
15 minutes to try to pack all that. First of all, my first initial reaction is that nobody knows nothing, as they say in Hollywood. You know, this year has proven that all of the experts, all of the alleged experts, and certainly people like myself, don't know what's going on, because the whole rise of Donald Trump and all that has caught everybody by surprise. And I think, but I also think it goes to what you're kind of, the main thrust of your question, which is that in terms of the role of religion and the polls and so on, I think there's a superficial side to that, where our participation rates in churches and worship services declining, and obviously the answer is yes. However, does that mean that people's deeply held moral and religious outlooks or metaphysical outlooks do not have an impact on how they vote? I think that answer is clearly no. I think people still do have deeply held beliefs and ethical outlooks and so on, and they still do vote on with those in mind. So I would distinguish between sort of the, and I wouldn't belittle church attendance as superficial, but in terms of people's superficial identification with religious practice and some of their core beliefs, and I think those beliefs go deeper than religious practice. And therefore, I wouldn't write off the Christian voter or the moral values voter quite yet, even though the religious participation has declined and so on. I think
where is it grounded then? If it goes deeper than their religious convictions, I think the average listener to this show would think that convictions grounded in faith or brought up in faith would be the deepest convictions of all.
Yes, I agree, but they're brought up in faith, and I think people have perhaps drifted away from, I mean, you see this with young people. You know, young people typically don't go to church. You know, they've got better things to do. They find church boring, and sometimes deservedly so. This is Protestant, Catholic, and Jews. But when they start having children and start really examining their lives, I just guess the philosophical side of me thinks that eventually people's lives require them to you know, the realities of life require you to confront some basic questions. And eventually people do tend to drift back to church attendance and later in life. And I think even when people don't actually go that often, they still have deeply held ethical outlooks that shape how they vote, okay? So I think that in terms of the elections coming up, I think we're going to be surprised because I think there's going to be a lot bigger impact on the Christian voter than people really realize. But I have
The media after every election tries to announce the end of the quote religious right. They still call it the religious right, you know, going back to the 70s to Jerry Falwell and so forth. But yet, every election, national and congressional, that I've tracked in my research, continues to show that the switch of Christian voters from one party to the other, from one candidate to the other, often turns out to be the deciding factor.
Yes. But I think Catholics are in an odd position in all this because I don't think Catholics are particularly comfortable in the Republican Party as such. And yet,
I'll say that that's true. And,
yes.
And yet, you know, with the exception of converts like myself.
With the exception of converts like yourself?
Yeah. We're very comfortable there.
The Democrats are doing everything they can to drive Catholics away. So Catholics are an odd duck in American politics because I think they are kind of economically liberal, but there's, you know, this is a truism, but they are socially conservative. And so they don't really fit really well in either political party. That's why I have no clue how it's going to shake out in terms of the Republican nomination, because if the Republicans do nominate Donald Trump, I just don't know if the Catholic vote is going to go that way.
I've been in some meetings recently, and I mentioned this on another show where some socially conservative pro-life Catholics have said that they wouldn't even vote if Donald Trump was nominated, which I chastised them for that, and I'll explain that if you want me to. But is this what you're referring to?
Yeah, I mean, I think people are going to, you know, it's really going to be a delicate calculation for Catholics because I can't see them voting for Hillary, although many will. And yet Donald Trump is an unknown entity. It would be a real risk for the country to, if you agreed with him, say, on immigration or something, if some Catholic voters agreed with him perhaps on his immigration stand or think we have to do something about illegal immigration and thought that's a reason enough to vote for him, they're taking a big risk since nobody really knows his stands on anything else. So I think it's going to be a big dilemma for Catholic voters this election, more than most.
How do you think that the influence of Pope Francis is going to play out, especially with his emphasis on things like climate change?
I don't know. All of my Democrat friends absolutely love Pope Francis, of course, but all the people I know who actually go to church are a little more lukewarm. You know, they agree.
That's my observation as well, Robert.
Yeah. I think his emphasis on helping the poor and so on is going to reverberate with Catholics especially blue collar Catholics who are struggling to make means. I mean, the big untold story in this election, as far as I can tell, is that the economy has improved for the wealthy, but it hasn't improved for the vast majority of people. Almost everybody.
That's exactly right. And I've had some rather, wealthy friends of mine tell me that, and they kind of tell me that with a sad chuckle because, this administration has actually made that come about.
Yeah.
When they vowed to, do something quite different.
Yeah, I mean that's what people don't realize, is that a lot of people are still living paycheck to paycheck, and
50% of Americans are one paycheck from being on the street.
Yes, I've heard that, and I believe that because the cost of living is incredible, and anybody that has their own small business or something like that, they're really struggling. Obamacare is just incredibly burdensome for anybody that has their own businesses, small businesses. I mean, including me, I'm a writer, and my health care premiums went from, I've written about this extensively, about what on the street, what Obamacare really means. It went from, our monthly premium went from $358 a month 4 years ago to $950 a month.
I got you beat. I'm at $1,200 a month.
Yeah, okay.
And that's just for my wife and son.
Yeah.
I'm on Medicare now.
That's triple. It's tripled for me personally. And so for a lot of small businesses that have a few employees and they try to provide health care, just Obamacare alone is a major burden. And so I think there's a perception in the country that a lot of a lot of the wealth that Obama spread the wealth around, but it all went to Wall Street bankers and the super rich, and ordinary people are still struggling. So I'm not sure that necessarily translates though into support for Hillary Clinton, because that just means another 4 years or 8 years of Obama, and that's why I have no clue what's going to happen. If the choice comes down to between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, I don't know what the country is going to vote. I honestly have no clue.
Do
you know, Dale?
Well, no, because I remember back when I was a college professor in Georgia, and Bill Clinton was one of the nominees for the Democratic presidential slot. And I remember a student asking me, could Clinton never be elected president? And I staunchly said, no way. So after that, I've stopped making predictions.
Yes, I am a horrible procrastinator myself. I like Rand Paul just as a kind of a protest vote, and because he seems like the most dignified and presidential of the candidates, and I like the fact that he doesn't want to bomb every country on the slightest pretext. He seems a little more pacifistic in a sense, but he has 1% of the polling, the share of the vote. So obviously I am a poor picker of political candidates. But
do you think to get back to the question of the country's religiosity, are you in agreement with, you've already said that there are values that go deeper than poll numbers about religious identification and religious participation.
Yeah.
But do you think it's true that this country's great heritage of religious worship and religious faith is diminishing?
I think it is, but I'm hopeful. I'm not fatalistic about it, because I spent a lot of time in Europe, and Europe is supposedly one of the most secular of all places on Earth, even in Germany. And yet I find the churches are actually full in many places in Germany, and I find there is a underlying religiosity in Europeans that is utterly lacking in the United States. I think we are a far more secular culture than Europe is because of the culture. The culture of religion still endures in Europe in a way it doesn't in the United States, or it never existed in the United States. The remnants of Catholicism and evangelical Protestantism are still strong in Europe culturally, even if they supposedly have low church attendance. So I think these things go in cycles. America in the past had low religiosity at different periods, and then there's great revivals. And I just think that the inherent dynamics of reality impose themselves on people, and they eventually begin seeking for deeper answers than South Park can provide. And they start seeking, and then they eventually seek out the great traditions of wisdom, traditions of the world, and Christianity is one of them. And that inevitably leads back to religion. So I think these things are cyclical. And
I think you probably just shocked the listening audience when you said that the United States was more secular than Europe. I think I got to call you on that and ask you to explain why.
It's just a feel. I mean, when you're in allegedly godless Europe, you see roadside shrines, you see nuns on the streets, you hear church bells. You know, the saints' days are holidays. Even in England, saints' days are still holidays. In a way, they don't have the fetish about separation of church and state that we have in the United States. I mean, we have kind of ideologically committed to a civil public culture, okay, from the founding, for good or for ill. You know, some people say it would be for good. But I think that has effects. You know, I think we have a very superficial public Christianity in the United States. And in Europe, I just find that that cultural inheritance endures, and it does affect the way people, their outlooks. I mean, that's the whole Christian Democrat tradition in Europe that still is there, that still has a strong Catholic overtone to it. The Christian Democratic parties until recently were very strong. There's still a pretty dynamic commitment to social welfare in Europe. As I find in the United States, I think we have a very, very secular government and a very secular public culture. You know, religion is really pushed to the side. It's something you do privately if you must, but isn't a public thing. Whereas in Europe, religion always was a public thing, and that endures even if people don't go to church as much as they do in the United States, or at least, and many times say they're atheists. I know that sounds contradictory, but that's just my...
No, I mean, of course, I think that everyone who's traveled in Europe at all is moved and surprised by the grandeur of... of course, in some countries it's Catholic, in some it's Lutheran, and so forth. The grandeur of the centuries of religious tradition that they find embodied in the buildings and the artwork, the music. Basically, how I'm taking what you're saying is that, you know, after all, Europe's Christianity goes back 2,000 years. And our Christianity goes back, the United States Christianity goes back a little over 200 years.
Yes.
So the roots there are just far deeper.
Yeah, and we were founded on a separation of church and state. So we've kind of have this initial idea that, you know, religion really should be something that's just kept separate. you know, and in Europe never really had that, and it kind of evolved it later. But, you know, their instincts are still, I think, for religion to be out. I mean, I was just in Cologne, and it's just amazing. You come out of the the train station in Cologne, and you know the Dom, the Cologne Cathedral is just, it's just the center of the city. It just looms right above you.
Well, I love that, because that's where Thomas Aquinas went to school there, and he studied with Albert the Great in Cologne.
Cologne.
Yes.
Yeah. So that cathedral is just dominates the city. So as secular as the Germans tried to pretend to be, I mean, it's just there. And so I think that affects, you know, their religious outlook, whether they go to church or not. Well, we don't have that. So maybe you might be correct, the fact that the decline of church participation in the United States may have a much more dramatic effect on us than it does on the Europeans, because the Europeans have an overlay, a cultural inheritance of Christianity that we don't have. And so therefore, people stop going to church. Maybe they will eventually utterly lose touch with anything even remotely Christian, because it's not in our public spaces the way it is in Europe. So I've never really thought about that, but as we're talking, I'm starting to think about it now, so maybe I should be more worried. But I still hold out hope that the realities of life, just of just existence on the planet, inevitably force people to ask bigger questions than they normally ask, and that will lead people back eventually to some religion of some form.
I'm talking with author Robert Hutchinson, who's been on the show before, discussing his latest book, Searching for Jesus, New Discoveries in the Quest for Jesus of Nazareth. Hey, I want to ask you, you know, since we talked last time about your book, I understand that it's gotten a great deal of attention. Tell us about that.
Well, it's gotten some, you know. I mean, it's a kind of a scholarly, semi-scholarly book. It's not super scholarly, but, yeah, I've had fun. I've done a few TV interviews and stuff like that, and I'm trying to get the word out that you know, you don't have to believe everything that you hear in the media about what scholars supposedly say about Jesus, because the scholarship is shifting tremendously, for one thing, and a lot of the things that people hear are the latest or the most scientific ideas about Jesus actually may not be true. You know, that we were discovering that a lot of the things the scholars say today are actually 100-year-old ideas, and they're increasingly obsolete. I just read, it was just Ross in the New York Times, I don't know how to pronounce his name.
Dulac.
Whatever.
Yes.
He was basically just recently responding to this, to the criticism of his criticism of the Pope and the whole notion of divorce of the remarried and all that. And one of the basic points that this, this Catholic theologian used in criticizing him was that, well, we know that Jesus, you know, expected the end of the world to end in his lifetime. And therefore, basically Jesus was wrong. And therefore, maybe he was wrong.
I heard that argument when I was at Princeton Theological Seminary in the early 70s.
Right. So maybe he was wrong about other things. Maybe he was wrong about divorce. Maybe it was a culturally conditioned thing. And, you know, Ross's whole notion is, well, then why do we bother, you know, let's just throw it all out. You know, I mean, in other words, if nothing endures, if there is no definitive teaching at all, if everything is going to be judged by the signs of the times, including divorce and all that, which is about as strong a teaching of Jesus, a definitive teaching of Jesus you can find, then, you know, then why hold anything? That's his basic criticism of that. But I thought he actually could have raised a different objection, which is that the whole thrust of this guy's argument was that, well, scholars know that Jesus thought the world was coming to an end in his lifetime, and he was wrong about that. Well, that's actually not what scholars think. That's what scholars thought 100 years ago. New Testament scholars. This guy is advocating an outdated New Testament scholarship that is no longer a universally held opinion. And some of the latest, most radical New Testament, we're not talking about conservatives here, some of the most radical liberal New Testament scholars utterly reject the notion that Jesus thought the world was coming to an end in his lifetime. They strongly oppose that. Richard Horsley and John Dominic Crossan and Marcus Board, many of the most liberal of New Testament scholars, utterly reject that idea. So, this is like one of the founding principles for re-examining some of the moral teachings of the Catholic Church, is that, well, Jesus was culturally conditioned, and many of his ideas obviously were incorrect, and therefore we should also reevaluate some of these moral stands, like his opposition to homosexuality. Jesus didn't actually speak about homosexuality, but some things like that. We need to examine them in the light of new knowledge and so on. But in fact, Jesus may not have been wrong about the world coming to an end, because he may not have said that or believed it.
Would they make the same argument about the prophets of the Old Testament and their view of homosexuality?
Oh, sure. I mean, obviously they would say it's a culturally conditioned outlook, let us find the inner kernel of moral teaching they were arriving at. They'll say that homosexuality as practiced in ancient Palestine was indeed an exploitative and degrading practice. In the time of the New Testament, it was perhaps boy prostitutes and so on. And so, yes, sure, of course, that should be condemned because it's exploitative. But in the modern context, modern male homosexual relationships are not like that, and therefore we have to reevaluate the blanket opposition to homosexuality because it was a culturally conditioned thing. That's what they would say.
Yeah, that never stops when it comes to subverting the teaching of Scripture. I'm talking with Robert Hutchinson. We've been talking about religion in the United States, where we're at, and how it will influence the upcoming election. We'll be back with Robert Hutchinson just after this message.
The following is a message brought to you by the Catholic Biblical School of Michigan.
Psalm 23 teaches us about God through the image of a shepherd, as it illustrates what a good shepherd must know and do for his flock. A good shepherd knows how to find food and water and leads his sheep to those locations. A good shepherd knows the landscape. He knows where to find shade and which are the safe paths. A good shepherd is able to protect his sheep from those who want to destroy them. Thus, sheep are tended by a good shepherd and have safety and security, nourishment and rest. In John's Gospel, Jesus proclaims himself to be the good shepherd. Psalm 23 teaches us what Jesus offers to us as our shepherd and what he wants to provide for us in our daily lives. Let us pray that we will let Jesus guide, nourish, and protect us as our shepherd, that we may rest with him in this life and the next. This message is brought to you by the Catholic Biblical School of Michigan, CBSMICH.org.
This is Father Frank Pavone of Priests for Life. On January 22nd, the day of the March for Life in Washington, D.C., various religious groups, including Priests for Life, will gather for the annual National Interdenominational Prayer Service honoring the preborn and their mothers and fathers. This service, which starts with a Mass, has been held for over 20 years and takes place in Constitution Hall. This year, we will welcome singer Tony Melendez, who became famous when he played the guitar with his feet on the occasion of the visit of Pope John Paul II to the United States. Tony is a strong witness to the value of life, even when beset with various disabilities. His strong spirit and beautiful music will be sure to inspire you. See more details at nationalprayerservice.com. This is Father Frank Pavone on Ave Maria Radio.
I'm back with Robert Hutchinson, who is author of many books. We've been talking a bit about his latest, Searching for Jesus, New Discoveries in the Quest for Jesus of Nazareth. But he's also got books on the Vatican, books about the vices, a parody of Bill Bennett's bestseller, Book of Virtue. And he used to be a editor of the Hawaii magazine and Hawaii bureau chief for the Hollywood Reporter. Before we move to the question of religion and faith, how long were you a bureau chief for the Hollywood Reporter, Robert?
Oh, just 3 years. I just did that.
Just 3 years? That's a long time.
Yeah. It was fun. It was a great.
Now, what did that, I mean, what did that entail?
I covered the film and TV production in the islands, and this was in the Magnum PI days, so it was a lot of fun. I mean, I got to meet some Hollywood celebrities and so on. I was about behind the scenes, you know, like what was shooting in the islands and what the budgets were, and, you know, I was trying to promote Hawaii as a location to do film and TV production.
Is that when they did Jurassic Park down there?
Yeah, that was part of it. They did a shot that on Kauai. Yeah, it was, you know, a lot of TV shows would come through and just do specials. Like there was a T.J. Hooker did a special there, and, you know, and then they had various film festivals and stuff like that. So it was a, it was kind of a fun gig.
And when you came away from that and moved along, what was your takeaway about the movie business?
I like the movie business. I think it's a great thing. I think there's a lot of conservatives are trying to get into the movie business, and they're kind of like a kind of a underground, you know, underground movement. You know, I think the church and Christians should use all forms of culture to proclaim the gospel, and if they have to do it surreptitiously, then so be it. But in fact, I read there's a Jesuit priest that's working in Hollywood as a screenwriter, and I hope to see what he does with that. So it is a great.
Well, there are a lot of screenwriters that have come out of the, you know, what we call the people of faith, and now are become very successful. It's a very different world, faith-wise, than it was, say, 30 years ago.
Yeah, of course. And, you know, I think there's no doubt there's a coarsening of culture and so on. But I don't think people should give up on any artistic medium. And so the film and TV business, I think, is just another medium that we should all work in if, you know, if we can and are drawn to it. I'm not particularly drawn to the business itself. I was merely covering it from a business point of view for a trade magazine. The Hollywood Reporter was a trade magazine. So.
Oh, it wasn't what do they call them, Hollywood tell-all magazine?
Oh, no, not at all. It was just the opposite. It was for the business. It was the business side of it. It was for the insiders. It was all about, so you know, who was doing what the budgets were, you know, interviewing directors and people like that. It was it used to be, it's now gotten a little glossy and fancy and everything, but back in those days it was literally a trade magazine.
You know, you probably remember this, but back in the George W. Bush days, the two terms, the two presidential elections, from the very beginning of his nomination in 2000, he was pilloried whenever he mentioned his faith, which he didn't go out of the way to do, frankly, and which would come up, especially when he was questioned on abortion and gay marriage and those kinds of issues. And eventually, it wasn't too long before Bush and his supporters, including yours truly, were labeled as theocons. In fact, on my bookshelf here next to where I'm talking to you, I have a whole line of books that came out just before the 2004 election in an effort to scare people off from George W. Bush for his enforcement, as it were, of his faith views on the political process. And it also was ironic, as I told you during the break, that during the 2008 campaign, it was Barack Obama who mentioned God and faith more than any other candidate in the primary and in the general campaign.
Yes.
Why is it that the left, when they bring religion to bear, faith to bear, are not criticized as being theocons, and why, you know, why is it that it's only the socially conservative crowd that gets accused of that?
Well, you already know the answer to that. That's because the media that covers these campaigns are overwhelmingly Democrat and liberal in their outlook, so they're not going to criticize someone on the Democrat side for occasionally invoking God because they're in sympathy with what they're saying. But
well, let me ask you the deeper question. The deeper question is, what kind of religion is it that the left embraces or even tolerates when it comes to public affairs? What is their religion?
Well, I think the real religion is kind of a secular humanism. But one thing I've learned recently, my wife is going back to school, and she took a statistics class. And the statistics professor told her that what Barack Obama had in the 2008 campaign, he had something like 10,000 paid statisticians and poll analysts. And the Romney had something like 50. And that he was crafting his messages on a daily basis on the basis of what polling data had told him. So he was getting instant feedback, and they were very scientifically modifying their messages so they would reverberate perfectly with what their audience liked to hear. And so even if Barack Obama himself is basically a secular humanist with a very secular outlook, he could tell from his polling data that even liberal Christian, liberal Democrat audiences do believe in God and are Christians and do want to hear the invocation of biblical principles of mercy and fairness and so on. And so he was able to flavor his speeches with those kinds of messages that reverberated with even with his liberal audiences. So I think they have learned that hostility to religion does not work well in the United States, overt hostility to religion in a political context, and they're willing to do that. Now, with Republicans, on the other hand, I think that there is a perception that Republicans actually believe what they say about religion, and the Democrats are able to gin up nervousness about that, and that there would be some sort of a theocracy imposed on America, which I just find ludicrous, because the humanism that the Democrats embrace is just as much a religion, just as much an imposition. And gay marriage is a perfect example of that. It was an undemocratic imposition on the nation of a view of marriage rejected by most people, there was no vote on it. It was just simply imposed. It was a profoundly anti-democratic thing to do. And, so the notion that the Democrats or liberals or progressives don't have an ideology that they're more than willing to impose on the majority is just ludicrous.
I have one question I've posed to people who throw that argument at me, the theocracy argument. Is this, and that is, let's say that I was a candidate who was a Nietzschean, that is a follower of the philosophy of Friedrich Nietzsche. The consequence of eliminating faith affirmations, discussions of the relationship of faith to morality and politics, would mean that my confidence in the philosophy of Nietzsche would be privileged. It would have a privileged status in terms of public discourse, precisely because he was an atheist and he announced God is dead, which means no one could object to my bringing Nietzsche to the table because he didn't believe. He wasn't espousing a faith. But they can object to me bringing Jesus Christ to the table.
Well, they can object all they want, but I think people instinctively realize that that it's silly to tell a politician that they cannot discuss or vote from or shape the policies based on their most closely held beliefs, and it's hypocritical. The thing about the Democrats is they love to say, like in the case of abortion, that they have this strongly held belief, but they don't have no right to impose that belief on others. Well, that's exactly what politics is. Politics is the expression of people's deeply held beliefs. You know, we imposed the belief that slavery was wrong on the South, and that to me, you know, the argument that Joe Biden uses, so how he can say he's personally opposed to abortion but has no right to impose that argument or that belief on the rest of the country, that's exactly the same argument the Democrats used about slavery. They said that, well, if you didn't like slavery, you didn't have to own slaves. You know, they said the same thing about slavery that they say about abortion. And yet most people think that it was right to abolish slavery, even though that meant imposing that belief on Southerners who own slaves.
the left, and I don't mean all Democrats, just I'm talking here about the radical left, because there are Republicans, by the way, who are very, very uncomfortable with bringing faith into political discussions as well. They seem to be, they don't have the upper hand at this moment, but they certainly had the upper hand for a long, long time.
Yeah, establishment Republicans.
The left isn't ever willing to look at its self-contradictions. And certainly the kind of historical contradictions that you're just you're naming, I mean, it was slavery. When I was a college professor, I wouldn't let people get away with that. Of course, I had a captive in a room. But, you know, it seems like in the way televised debates and talk shows are set up, there always seems to be a, you know, the way they don't do our conversations, or, except for Charlie Rose. You know, he does 20 or 30 minute. But there's never a chance really to back any of these folks into the corner and make them admit the basic contradiction of their positions.
Yes, I agree. You know, and I think these things, but that's what democracy is the hashing out these big questions in a public way and voting. I'm a big believer in democracy as a is probably the best way to resolve our political disputes. And one of the things that sort of we've never really resolved in the United States, and one of the kind of inherent contradictions in our Constitution, is that we want to have a basic law and establish fundamental rights which are not subject to majority vote, of course, and a lot of people think, well, of course that makes sense because human rights should not be subject to the whim of the majority. But that inevitably creates the situation which we have, which is that all important questions are increasingly settled not by democratic debate but by a bunch of guys in black robes, judges, who settle all important questions. So they'll leave to us little things like how much sewer pipe we need to buy and prudential judgments like that. But any important question is no longer settled by democratic debate. It's settled by the courts. And I find that is going to inevitably create the culture wars that exist in the United States, which, again, are less existent in Europe because Europe is a parliamentary system. I'm not a big – I'm coming across as a big Europhile. I'm just
– You kind of are, yeah.
You know,
I mean, you like the International Court of Justice, right, in The Hague?
Well, no, yeah, that's right. But and that's just because there's two instances where I'm saying this. But again, there's not quite the cultural battle, the culture war, because these things are settled through the give and take of democracy in a parliamentary system. Whereas in the United States, we kick the can down the road and we let the Supreme Court settle it. You know, and that I think ultimately is destructive. And I'm increasingly wondering if it's a good idea to have, or it might be a better idea to try and let us argue these things out in a democratic way instead of letting the court settle everything. Even though I'm not sure how that would work out, I'm not sure what that means in terms of the Bill of Rights and fundamental rights and so on. I'm still thinking about all this stuff. But I think it would be a lot less acrimonious politics, certainly. You know, we basically make compromises. You know,
tell our listeners a little bit about your faith / political journey. Where have you come from on these questions?
My parents are both Democrats. You know, they distrusted.
Where you grew up in California?
I grew up in Seattle area, Pacific Northwest.
Okay, so they had to be Democrats if they were from up there, right?
Yeah, well, my father was a judge, a lawyer and a judge, and that therefore makes him a Democrat. The point is, when you think about it, lawyers are inevitably Democrats because, you know, their whole business depends on having lots of laws. And so you need to have lots of laws to function as a lawyer. The more laws, the better. And so lawyers tend to be Democrats. And my mother was also a Democrat and distrusted big business and thought that they would screw the little guy if given half the chance. And we need a strong government to protect us from the predatory businesses. So I was raised in that. And so naturally I rebelled against it and began in college to look at free market teachings and things like that. And then when Reagan was elected, I found him to be a refreshing change. I found him as a liberator. And I became,
but were you a Democrat at this point when you were first?
I was a nothing at that point. I was still, okay. I didn't know what I was. But when Reagan was elected in 1980, I found him refreshing. I found the turning their back on the drug culture of the 70s with which I was raised. And, you know, this is your brain on drugs and all that.
I promise not to go down that road with you.
Well, I'm not talking about me personally. I'm just saying as the
right, I know. I'm
people.
Just kidding.
I found it as a liberation, and so I became a partisan Republican and became increasingly conservative.
What did your parents think of that, Robert?
Oh, they think I was crazy, you know. But it was inevitable.
Was it acrimonious or was it in good humor?
No. It wasn't acrimonious. You know, I still understood the Democratic outlook in terms of business and all that.
And how did your faith play into this?
Well, it was a challenge because I was deeply, I'm a deep supporter of Dorothy Day and Daniel Berrigan. I'm basically a peacenik, you know. I find the current crop of Republicans to be overly bellicose and war-mongering a bit. I find the whole, there's been a coarsening of rhetoric on the Republican side. They now talk about taking out people, and it's like video games. There's no sense that we're talking about killing people, you know.
Kind of like NFL and concussions.
Yeah, it's just been you know, there's a lot of chicken hawks on the Republican side, which are people who've never actually been in the military or war, who are more than willing to talk tough on the military, and I find that very disturbing. So I'm not a natural Republican.
No, if you're a Dorothy Day follower, it's kind of remarkable that you're a Republican, period. I mean, I think a lot of fans of Dorothy Day would say that just doesn't fit.
Well, to me it does, because I find the Democratic Party has become increasingly authoritarian and anti-family.
Followers of Dorothy Day, don't they refer to themselves as nihilists?
Actually, they refer to themselves as anarchists, and I've actually...
Yeah, I mean, yes, anarchists. I once had a graduate student at Fordham come to me and declare herself an anarchist, and frankly, I didn't know what she was talking about. Could you explain that to us?
Yeah, I would say I would sometimes jokingly call myself a Christian anarchist.
What does that mean?
That means you don't have any loyalty to a political party as such. You're basically an independent.
Well, why call yourself an anarchist? Because that sounds like you're getting ready to throw a Molotov cocktail at somebody.
Yeah, it does, and that's why I don't mean it seriously. But in terms of, you know, put not your faith in princes, says the psalmist, you know. And so I don't think Christians should have their ultimate faith in any political party as such. And, you know, our Lord...
Dorothy Day was pro-life, wasn't she?
She was pro-life, of course she was pro-life, even though she...
Some of that came from her reading of Sigrid Undset's great novel, Kristen Lovgren's Daughter.
Yes, which I have tried to read.
Oh, I've read it four. It's my favorite novel, Robert.
I like the new translation better.
I've read it four times.
Oh, okay.
I think it's one of the great novels of all time.
Yeah.
But it's profoundly pro-life, that book. And it was part of Day's conversion.
I love Dorothy Day. I even love Daniel Berrigan, even though I don't follow him politically all the way down, but I think he is a prophetic voice that we need to listen to.
It's funny you should say that, because, you know, when I was younger and I became Catholic at 34, I had a kind of instinctive disregard for people, you know, that opposed the Vietnam War that way. But now I see them differently. I see them great with much more sympathy. And I see the kind of, may I call it, heroism that was attached to what they did and what they stood for. Because they must have gone through a lot in terms of their positions, but they stood by them.
Yes, and I mean, isn't that what a priest should be doing, is speaking out against killing and things like that? I mean, even if I can imagine being a general and saying that I need to do what I need to do, but still wanting to hear that prophetic witness, still want my conscience to be bothered, and still wanting those priests out there denouncing me, even if I decide that in justice and morality I must engage in this military campaign.
But Robert, given these, tensions in your own faith/political belief. I mean, you've got Dorothy Day on one side and Ronald Reagan on the other. I would say that most people would raise their eyebrows at that. Where does that end up putting you? I mean, can you identify strongly with anybody who's running for the nomination at present?
Right now, as I said, the only candidate I really like is Rand Paul, because he is the and I'm not a idiot.
He's the anarchist.
Yes, that's the anarchism in me. And the opposition to reckless militarism overseas. I don't think we need to invade every country as soon as we see a problem. And I think
we don't think we should take out ISIS before they gather more power.
My position on ISIS is that we squandered the precious resources of lives and treasure in a stupid campaign in Iraq, Now that we have an enemy we should deal with, which is ISIS, who are a genuine threat to the world and are genuinely barbaric, we are too exhausted financially and in terms of what we've asked of our military to do it.
We're like Europe after World War I, especially England, didn't want to take Hitler on until Hitler had enough momentum to create, you know, a five-year war.
That's right. They were too exhausted by the stupidity of World War I to take on a real menace, which was Hitler, and therefore it led to even more destruction. So that's my position on...
That's my fear about the situation, is that you've really nailed it, and that is that, you know, with Iraq and Afghanistan leaving a bad taste in our mouths, we now see the rise of a Hitler-like movement in terms of its penchant for violence and for rape, you know, for total destruction. And yet we're playing nicey-nice with them.
Yeah. No, because we're too – I mean, our military is stretched thin as it is. And I mean, I live right next to a Marine base. These guys are on their fifth and sixth tours. It asks a lot of these families. And now we're too exhausted to do what we should do, which is to deal with ISIS, because...
Well, it shouldn't be unilateral.
Huh?
It shouldn't be unilateral.
Well, yeah, and it wasn't unilateral with Iraq. Bush actually, unlike Obama, took the trouble to go out and get a coalition put together and got a UN resolution supporting his actions.
What would Dorothy Day do? We got 2 minutes left. Seriously, what would Dorothy Day do?
Dorothy Day would stick to her principles and says war is never a solution. But I think occasionally, even though I want her to be there every day saying those things, occasionally we do have to act. I am not a pacifist. I believe Hitler did have to be stopped. But we should constantly listen to Dorothy Day and take her position as the default position, that war is almost always a bad idea. The only major international figure who opposed the Iraq war, when everybody supported it, most of the Democrats, almost all of the United Nations, was John Paul II. He said it is a bad idea, and no one listened to him. and it was a bad idea, and we all recognize it as a bad idea now. So I do want Dorothy Day out there and Daniel Berrigan telling us, stop, even if we have to sometimes overrule them.
I think that's wise. Robert Hutchison, thanks for giving Church and Culture another chance.
Thank you for having me on again, Bill.
And I'll have you back in the near future. You're a great guest. And to all of you who have been listening, please join me at this time on this day next week.
If you have any comments or questions about Church and Culture, you can contact Deal Hudson at dhudson@avemariaradio.net.
Light of the East, weekends on Ave Maria Radio.
I'm Father Thomas Loya. This week on Ave Maria, the new year in both the civil calendar and the liturgical calendar has us looking back in gratitude, yet forward in a spirit of manifestation, illumination, and renewal.
Saturday evenings at 8:30 and Sunday mornings at 9 on 990 WDEO Ave Maria Radio.
Here's a Family Minute with child psychologist Dr. Ray Guarendi from Ave Maria Radio.
Do you look confident when you discipline? Some years ago, I was called into a classroom of a veteran teacher. This lady had more knowledge about kids in her little finger than I had in every letter after my name. Child was acting up in the back of the room. She stopped reading, and she walked ever so deliberately, ever so slowly, to the spot where he was. She put her face in her hands, never uttered a word, and he ceased what he was doing. And I watched her as she quietly walked back up to her desk. Her whole demeanor, her comportment said, "This is my class. I don't know where else you do these things, but you don't do this in my class, and if you do, there will be consequences." And she didn't say a single word, but the way she carried herself left a lesson for me. I will say that to you. In disciplining a child, walk confidently, talk confidently, breathe confidently. Carry yourself as if you are in command, in charge here, in a quiet sort of way. And you may find that you'll discipline a lot less. When it comes time to discipline, substance is important, but we have forgotten how important style is. I'm Dr. Ray.
How do you get in touch with your roots? No, don't dig up that tree in the backyard. Do a little cultural digging instead. On today's Homeschool Heartbeat, your host, Mike Smith, suggests hands-on projects for teaching your children about their cultural heritage.
Hopefully you've been inspired this week to explore family and cultural heritage in your homeschool. If so, there are lots of hands-on projects and field trips that your kids can do to supplement a study of their cultural heritage. Consider some field trips to go along with the study of family and cultural history. You might check for historical museums related to specific ethnic groups, either in your area or if you go to visit relatives in another part of the country where your family originally settled. Your family vacation might incorporate a pilgrimage to some places significant to your family, state, or cultural heritage. Something you can do from home is to research cultural traditions related to significant events or holidays. Are there special foods, celebrations, or other customs associated with life events, like births, marriages, or birthdays? Holidays are another great way to focus on heritage. Many cultures have special Christmas traditions that your family would enjoy reviving in your home. Ethnic holidays like Chinese New Year, St. Patrick's Day, Cinco de Mayo, or Oktoberfest are also good opportunities to explore historical culture. Wondering how to celebrate? You could check for ethnic cookbooks and help your kids create tasty tributes to family history. If you have children young enough to enjoy dress up, you could make traditional costumes to show.